We are approaching the end of the week, and so we have just a little left. Some of you took a test last night, I understand. Hope you did well on that. I've been given the job of doing a few policy talks this week, and this is my last on medical care. I have had a rather personal interest in the economics of medical care since my father was a physician. Before he passed away, was the president-elect of a free market-oriented association of doctors called the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, the AAPS. So if you're interested in what doctors that are not statists have to say about medical policy, I believe their website is aapsonline.org. Dr. Prince is saying yes. So you might check that out. Of course, medical economics has been in the news a good bit lately because of the Supreme Court decision in the United States just a few weeks ago on what's commonly called Obamacare. The dispute over whether or not this is a tax, the Obama administration was happily telling all of us that this is not a tax, and since the Supreme Court decided that it was constitutional because it was a tax, he's happily telling us all that, well, he disagrees with the Supreme Court, but he's happy that they approved what he wanted. So I'm actually not going to say that much about Obamacare. It's a several thousand page piece of legislation, which you're welcome to read on your own time if you like. What I'd like to do is speak in more general terms about what government intervention in medical care does, how it affects our economy, and how it, more particularly, it affects the quality of care. Bob Higgs gave us a talk earlier this week on the FDA and the damage that the FDA does to human health. I'm going to spend just a few minutes adding some details to that he may not have had time to cover in his talk, just because I think that's an important example of regulatory failure. Not quite sure I've seen an example of regulatory success, but in this case, the regulatory failure does cause a massive amount of human suffering and death. So if you're interested in further reading on this, I recommend highly Bob Higgs' book, Hazardous to Our Health, The FDA Regulation of Healthcare Products. Just to touch on some of this, we know that the FDA regulates a number of things regarding the admission of new drugs to the U.S. market. It also regulates advertising. They even regulate drugs that have already been approved but are now intended for use as in the treatment of some other new disease. AZT, for example, which is an AIDS drug, was initially an anti-cancer drug and then became used to treat AIDS. And some companies we know will not find it profitable to go through the approval process to get their drug approved for this new purpose. The same chemical combination, we know that what the side effects are likely to be because it's been out on the market for a long time, and yet if we want to use it for some new purpose, now we have to go through the several hundred million dollar process of getting the FDA to approve it. So the new use of a drug, which may be a could be even a more human welfare enhancing use than the old use, could remain relatively unknown. One example of that we'll see is in the case of aspirin. Tom DiLorenzo wrote in a Mises Daily, I think this was from last year, he says, new drugs do consumers no good if they do not know about them. Advertising restrictions imposed by the FDA, therefore, prop up the profits of incumbent drug marketers at the expense of newcomers in the industry and of consumers. I think sometimes you get the impression, or you could get the impression if you look at government regulation, that bureaucrats are kind of bumbling idiots, or maybe they're malevolent and they really don't like people and they're trying to do things to make people suffer. And I can understand how you get that impression, but what I think is a better way to look at bureaucracy and regulation is that they are responding to certain groups, special interest groups, that do benefit from the regulation. There are some people who are made better off by the restrictions on advertising and the restrictions on new drugs. Unfortunately, the restrictions confer these benefits at great cost to other groups in our society. I mentioned aspirin. And this is an older story, but I think it illustrates the point fairly well. The FDA commissioner, Frank Young, in 1988 told all the companies making aspirin that they could not advertise the benefits of aspirin in reducing risks for first heart attacks. If they did, the FDA would bring legal action. So as a consequence, the ban on advertising aspirin for that purpose cost tens of thousands of needless deaths per year. We know also, and I won't belabor this because, again, Bob Higgs spent some time on this yesterday and did a great job of explaining this process, so I don't have to revisit all of this, but he said that the FDA approval process itself can induce delays, sometimes decade-long delays in the approval of drugs, and sometimes they're turned down, which means that we do not have the benefit of the drug for many years to come. And that FDA approval process has changed since the founding of the FDA, most notably in 1962. In 1906, medications were not to contain substances that were deemed harmful to your health. Even that is a kind of a subjective appraisal of a chemical. Pretty much anything that you can ingest can be poisonous if you consume enough of it. There are people who have died from ingesting too much water. It's possible for anything to be hazardous to your health. Doctors will sometimes tell you that all drugs are basically poisons. It's just a matter of it's going to kill the disease faster than it kills you. It matters a great deal what the quantity is and what the risk of the disease is versus the risk of the medication that you're putting into your body. In 1938, the manufacturers were then required to demonstrate the safety of the product. So we have to have efficacy and we have to have safety by 1962. And as a result, the approval process has now lengthened in time so that prior to 1962, a process that might have taken about 180 days now takes 10 years in some cases. By the late 1970s, that time period had increased dramatically. And so now we have a drug that may be very beneficial to people, but you've got 10 years of people suffering and dying before people are allowed to use the product. I think I mentioned in this talk last year, there was a doctor at Boston Children's Hospital who had found that a drug it was a nutritional supplement allowed in Europe for premature babies that had damaged livers, was actually very effective not only at reducing the onset of liver problems in premature children, but also in reversing liver damage that had already been incurred. And the doctor would like to have used the drug here in the U.S., but it could only be used on an experimental basis because the FDA had not approved it. And the manufacturer was not going to pursue the process of getting the drug approved here because it was going to be so expensive, and because by the time they got through the 8 to 10 year process of getting the drug approved and $800 to $1 billion of cost, the company already had another nutritional supplement in the pipeline that would be more effective. And if they're going to spend $1 billion getting the FDA to approve something, they'd rather spend the money on getting a more recent, updated product approved. So we run into numerous problems with this delay and expense. Septra, was a drug, antibiotic, that was delayed by 5 years, introducing that to the U.S. market. George Hitchings estimated that this delay cost 80,000 lives in the United States. Beta blockers, I believe Professor Higgs mentioned this yesterday, the lag there may have cost 250,000 lives in the United States. Then you get drugs that are not necessarily beneficial, but you get the CDC recommending that people use these, and then they create more damage. A rotavirus vaccine, for example. Almost all children contract rotavirus by the age of 5. We get about 55,000 hospitalizations and 20 to 40 deaths a year. And then in 1998, the FDA approved a vaccine called RotaShield, which the CDC then recommended for all infants within a year of the approval by the FDA. And when the CDC recommends something, often the pathway by which this is pushed onto families is through school immunization requirements. Public school admissions require you to have certain immunizations, and then this is the way in which this is enforced. So over 1 million children were immunized, and we got 2 deaths and 99 cases of a bowel obstruction, evidently linked to this new vaccine. But we also know that the vaccine adverse effect reporting system only catches about 10% of those actual vaccine-caused injuries. So you multiply this by 10, and we get about as many deaths as were being caused by the disease itself, around 20 or so perhaps caused by the disease, and then 20 or so caused by perhaps by the vaccine. So is this creating any kind of good in this lengthy process of getting drugs approved, or is it causing people damage? We also see a link between the pharmaceutical industry and the FDA, as Tom DiLorenzo had pointed out in the quote that I mentioned earlier, so that the pharmaceutical industry can benefit by restricting competition. We know that in the case of the rotavirus vaccine, one member of the CDC committee that recommended this holds a patent on the vaccine, a little bit of a conflict of interest, and was paid by a large pharmaceutical company to develop the vaccine. And furthermore, did not recuse himself from voting on issues surrounding the vaccine. It becomes a cozy club of bureaucrats and pharmaceutical manufacturers in some cases, and very often the pharmaceutical manufacturers manage to keep out their smaller, perhaps more innovative competition by keeping these very expensive requirements in place. I won't spend a lot of time here on the Vioxx case, but one scientist indicated that the FDA was trying to prevent people from understanding the full magnitude of the harm caused by Vioxx. And he said that one of the reasons that this was happening is because the FDA was serving the pharmaceutical industry. So the FDA is not exactly being forthcoming with information when something is harmful, which creates another avenue by which people can be badly hurt. We get an extremely expensive process, which even if we were to put aside the fact that the process is preventing possibly beneficial drugs from entering the market, just the financial cost of this is causing harm. Mainstream economists will have done some quantitative work on this, indicating that if people suffer a loss of income, that's going to generate some statistical losses of life, by which we mean we don't know exactly who's going to die because their income is reduced, but we do know that higher income means a longer life expectancy. We do know that when people make more money, they tend to be less subject to various hazards. So if we look at the $800 million, and that's kind of on the low side, Professor Higgs mentioned $1 billion. If we take $800 billion as the cost of bringing a new drug onto the market, and we take a kind of a conventional measure of how much of an income reduction it takes to cost a statistical life, maybe $17 million conservatively, then we find that we lost about 47 lives just because of the expense. Even if they use the $800 million to go dig trenches outside the FDA building and fill them back in, it would still cost us lives in the process, even if they were not using that money to prevent drugs from entering the market that would be beneficial. So we have numerous problems just in this one aspect of government regulation of medical care, just in the pharmaceutical side. Whenever a bureaucracy gets involved in a decision about medical care, whether it's what chemical you're allowed to put into your body and what chemicals you're not allowed to put into your body, we run into this problem of dispersed knowledge. We know that the individual who is sick or may become ill is the one who is best able to assess personal costs, personal benefits, and that information that the patient has is informed largely by consultation with a physician. The physician is able to discuss these issues with the patient. The physician knows the patient, the patient's circumstances. The physician is able to evaluate all the other medical conditions that the patient may have, the income, the family situation, all of which is relevant to the choice of treatments. And then between the doctor on the spot and the patient who's assessing his own costs and benefits and level of discomfort and tolerance for risk, all of that decision-making can be done very effectively in that room between the doctor and the patient. But when you introduce a third party who's possibly thousands of miles away and does not know the situation that the patient finds himself in, we run into a real problem of inadequate knowledge on the part of the government. The government cannot intrude into this process of making a decision about a treatment without making the situation far worse. Conko and Arnett, in their 2008 article, noted that FDA scientists may know a lot about the drugs they evaluate from a chemical perspective. They may know about the average effects on users, but they know nothing about the individualized physiology of each patient. And I would add not just the physiology, but again, the family circumstances and other relevant details. So we have to, if we want patient well-being to improve, we have to make sure that the control over the decision about treatment is left in the hands of the patient in consultation with the doctor, not bureaucrats thousands of miles away. Ludwig von Mises, in his excellent short work, Bureaucracy, noted that government, by its very nature, has to be formalistic, rigid, unyielding, and it is going to be punitive in its dealings with people who violate its regulations. The core problem that bureaucracy of all kinds faces is a lack of measure of success or failure. Now, you've been here all week. You know that by this point, the market provides a measure of success and failure. It's not infallible, but it's a whole lot better than the guesswork that bureaucrats have to make, that they have to rely on. And the market provides us with profit and loss information. If your firm is profiting, it's because you're providing something that people want. You can't force people to consume your product in a free market. You can only entice them by offering something that they're persuaded will make them better off. And if your product ends up not making somebody better off, then your profits will fall, it'll turn into losses, and you'll end up going bankrupt. Bureaucrats don't have that measure of profit and loss to rely upon. F.A. Hayek, in his well-known 1945 article, The Use of Knowledge in Society, pointed out that knowledge is some of the most relevant knowledge we use in making decisions is not something that can be translated into statistical form and then sent off to a bureaucrat to make a centralized decision. Newt Gingrich is, he's involved in a lot of things, but one of the things that he has tried to do is turn medicine into a more centralized process by requiring the digitization of patient information so that a doctor walks into a room with a patient, fills in the blanks on some kind of digital form, and then sends this off to the central office somewhere where a bureaucrat looks at this information that says, oh, well, we have X, Y, and Z, and therefore the appropriate treatment for this patient based on X, Y, and Z would be treatment number 130. But we see that the doctor didn't prescribe treatment number 130. The doctor prescribed something else or chose not to do anything at all with the patient, and therefore the doctor must be in error. This is extremely dangerous for patient well-being and not to mention the doctors who find themselves caught in this system by which doctors are held responsible by some distant authority that doesn't know anything about the individual circumstances of time and place. How can you decide on what happened, the quality of some interaction between a doctor and a patient in, a few minutes of consultation, simply by looking at a form? And ultimately, there's really no way to do that. So what we have seen in the United States and more particularly in other countries is an increase in the scale of medical care. The interactions between doctors and patients are evaluated by people far removed from the situation. We've seen this going on for decades now. One of the earlier examples of this was the appearance of CPT coding so that you'd have, this doctor records the, it's called current procedural terminology. They record a number that matches what's going on with the patient, and then this is used to evaluate the quality of what the doctor has done. So a conscientious doctor is sometimes put into a very difficult situation where they say, well, I know what's good for the patient, and it's this, based on the circumstances that I've seen in my office. But if I say this to the distant bureaucrat, they're going to look at this, and they're going to look up their little manual that says this number equals that treatment, and they're going to question what I've done. Therefore, the doctor's either has to do what's good for the patient, or the doctor has to do what satisfies the bureaucrat, and those are not the same thing. So often, a conscientious doctor will have to creatively bend or break the rules to help the patient out. Doctors tend to be people who care about their patients. And unfortunately, when you make caring about a patient and individualized care something that can be punished, you discourage people from getting into the medical profession. You discourage doctors from doing what is best. And so the bureaucrats who find that doctors are not following their rules decide to do what tyrants everywhere do, which is we'll make the rule, the punishments so draconian that the doctors can't ignore this. They have to follow our rules, or we will just sledgehammer them into submission. We'll threaten them with loss of their medical license or something of that nature. And again, I'll point you back to Mises, his book, Economic Freedom and Interventionism, where he says that it's important to remember Government interference is always either the threat of violent action or violent action itself. One example of this is what we've seen. This is from the this is information that I gained indirectly from the AAPS, the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons. And what we've seen is that physicians are increasingly being brought up on criminal charges by these sort of roving strike teams operating under Medicare regulations. So what they'll do, according to this article I have here, is the government will rely on Medicare data analysis, again, looking at the numbers, looking at the treatment, and then they'll try to find what they call fraudulent billing and lapses in quality, and they'll go after physicians who are accused of doing something that is medically unnecessary, simply to milk the government out of Medicare dollars. One example would be an office manager, Edgardo Perez de Leon in Michigan, used to manage his wife's internal medicine practice. He was convicted of 12 felony counts of Medicaid false claims and health care false claims offenses because he coded patient visits that didn't involve a patient a physical examination as an office visit. Well, he looked at the codes available to him, and he decided, well, the closest match available consistent to what we did was an office visit. So they classified it as an office visit. An office visit isn't necessarily going to involve a physical examination, so he figured he was doing what was best. But he spent a year in jail for that. The family house was threatened with foreclosure. Their children were sent back to Puerto Rico to live with family because they couldn't afford to support them. And he was never able to get a clarification of what the government meant by an office visit. A 2000 survey of doctors regarding Medicare fraud found that fraud was not only easy, but unintentional errors were virtually unavoidable. And if you make an unintentional error as a doctor, you can be accused of fraud, and there's effectively no way to defend yourself against this. 82% of the doctors surveyed said that they had an increased fear of prosecution or investigation in the past 3 years. 71% said we're making changes in our practice to avoid the threat of prosecution, including restricting services to Medicare patients. A Medicare patient walking in represents an enormous liability that any treatment you provide, even if you're doing everything according to what you understand the rules to be, you're still incurring the liability of a possible Medicare strike team coming after you and depriving you of your medical license. 20% said, we don't accept new Medicare patients because we've gotten hassled by Medicare or threatened. One-fourth who do not accept new patients, if you take out those that do not accept new Medicare patients, those that do, 9% only do so under special circumstances. So this has meant that when the government pays for medical services, they're attaching such a liability for the doctor that the doctor is reluctant to even take these patients. It's similar to the problem that some doctors have faced with malpractice lawsuits. There are some states where it's very difficult for women to find an obstetrician because the liability incurred delivering a child is so great that doctors have backed out of that practice. They don't accept new patients. They're retiring, moving to other states, et cetera. There was a government, I think they call this the Government Accountability Office now. I'm not sure, but used to be the Government Accounting Office in 2002, found that 85% of the time Medicare customer service representatives gave the wrong answer to questions posed by physicians on how they should bill Medicare. So you call Medicare, you're a conscientious doctor, you call Medicare and you say, well, how do I resolve this issue? How do I code this particular patient encounter? Medicare gives you an answer. Medicare's wrong 85% of the time. So Medicare said, all right, well, we're going to get better. We're going to improve this. So they did a follow-up study 2 years later. They found it was 96% of the time they were giving the wrong answer. So what do you do? I mean, maybe you can just call Medicare, find out what their answer is, and then do the opposite. Maybe that would be. In fact, the policies and the regulations were so confusing that the Medicare bureaucrats answering the phone and policy experts who study this stuff couldn't understand the regulations themselves. And this is all pre-Obamacare, and it's several thousand pages of regulation. We have a conflict now created by the Medicare system in which hospitals have an incentive to cycle a lot of Medicare patients through because they're paid by the diagnosis. So you get diagnosed, hospital side of this is done, they want to get them out and make room for somebody else. On the other hand, you got the physicians who are paid by therapy. So the physician's incentive fundamentally is to keep the patients in the hospital for longer. These effects don't cancel each other out perfectly, so some patients wind up in the hospital too long, some patients wind up being dismissed too soon. It doesn't work out for the benefit of the patient. We've certainly seen higher costs for medical care in the United States. There's several reasons for this. One of the chief reasons is that there has been interposed between the patient and the care provider, a set of third-party payers, intermediaries. They tend to work, the intermediaries are tending to work for the government or an insurance company instead of for the benefit of the patient. So we get this kind of strange network of competing standards. The patient has the patient's standards. This is what I want done to my body. I want you to fix this. I can tolerate that other problem because of the difficulty of the therapy, the side effects, or so forth. But please do this for me. Fix this. Fix my broken knee or whatever it is. Then you've got the employer providing insurance in many cases to the patient. And there's competition among the insurance companies to try to get these employee contracts. So the patient is at least one step removed from the insurance company by the fact that the employer chose the insurance company. Typically, the employer would want to make the employees happy, but it does distance the employee from the insurance company by at least that one step. You've got the patient voting to try to influence the government in some way. We know that that's not terribly effective. And then we have the government regulating the care provider. We have insurance companies lobbying the government. Fairly convenient lately that they've been able to get the government to mandate that people buy their services. That's very nice if you can get the government to require people to buy what you have. And this is not the first time we've seen this. The government then regulates the insurance companies. The insurance companies impose their requirements on the care providers. So the care provider is stuck with, well, who do we pay attention to? We're being regulated by the government. We have insurance companies telling us what their standards are. And then we have the patient in our offices telling us what they want. So who do they listen to? Well, that's where you start to pay attention to where the money comes from. Today, in the United States, at least 45 to 50%, and I think slightly more than 50% now, is coming from the government. About 40% or so comes from insurance companies. And a piddling 10 to 15% comes from the patient. So if you're the doctor, the last person you're going to listen to is the patient, at least if you're paying attention to who's paying your bills. You want to make sure the insurance company is satisfied with you. You want to make sure that you don't run afoul of any kind of government regulation. And then once you've satisfied those things, I mean, the patient by himself is not going to be able to remove your medical license, but the government sure can. And the insurance company can cause a great deal of grief to you. So the doctor, whoever the care provider is, doctor, chiropractor, whoever else, is faced with a serious conflict of competing standards. Then we have the moral hazard problem. Moral hazard, in case you haven't run into this term before in economics classes or elsewhere, is the risk or the hazard that an insured person might behave in such a way that the claims are larger than they would be otherwise. So, for example, I have to have my eyes corrected. I wear glasses, and there are several ways to fix my vision. I could probably get my vision corrected with some kind of low-end glasses for $50 or so, and on the other end of the scale, I could get my vision corrected with some kind of laser surgery that might cost me $3,000. I chose something kind of in the middle. I didn't choose the laser surgery. I didn't choose the $50 pair of glasses. I don't remember what these were, but they were more than $50. So that's what I chose because I was paying the bill largely myself. So if an insurance company comes along or the government comes along and says, well, we're going to pay the bill, whatever the bill is to fix your vision, we'll pay it. Oh, well, I really think I need laser vision correction. It's $3,000, but it's not my $3,000. A couple, 3 years ago, my back was giving me problems, and I went to a chiropractor, and the chiropractor said, well, in order to treat you, we really need to get some x-rays and we need to get an MRI. So he said, if you call down to the MRI diagnostic place, they'll get you an appointment. You might even get seen today. Try that in Canada, by the way. So I did. In fact, I got seen that day or the next day, and I got my MRI, and I went back to the chiropractor with the MRI scan, and then he went from there. So I looked later at the bill for the MRI. I don't remember what it was, but it was a whole lot more than I would have been willing to pay had the money come out of my own pocket. I would have said, look, if I have to pay this out of my own pocket, then, doctor, you're just going to have to work off the x-rays because I'm not going to get the MRI. I don't remember what it was, but it was well over $1,000. My share of that was maybe 50 or 75 or something after my insurance picked up the tab. So my incentive is to not even look at the price in a lot of cases for diagnostic or treatment services. Why do I care? It's not my money. And of course, that's a moral hazard problem. So when a third party, an insurance company or a government, is paying for medical services, people tend to ignore price. Now, this is a fairly typical supply and demand diagram. And in an ordinary market, you'd see people paying a price right about here. But if the government says, well, this is not quite the way it is in the United States, so this would be more along the lines of, say, the British system where the government says, we'll pick up the tab. If the price in a marketplace would be here, but the government says, we'll pick up the tab instead, that means the price to the individual patient is near zero. So what's my quantity demanded at near zero? It's way over here. So my incentive is to consume a whole lot of medical care out to the point where the marginal benefit to me is near zero. So that's what I want. That's what I demand. But in a market system, the quantity supplied would be here. And governments don't provide zero medical care. They provide some. But if they provided the quantity that people say they want at a near zero price, government would be incurring, extend the supply curve up here, the government would be incurring a marginal cost that's extremely high. Well, governments can't afford that. No governments can. So what governments end up doing is they end up rationing. They say, well, we can't give people the very large amount of medical care that they say they want when it's zero. So the government then engages in a number of rationing schemes. One of them is to make people wait in line. And so we get waiting. We get long lines for things like surgeries. There's something like 800,000 people in the UK waiting in line at any given time for surgeries. And some people are deteriorating in their condition while they're waiting. In fact, there was a case last year, the year before, where one of the National Health Services trustees died while waiting in line for medical care in the UK. Of course, that's tragic, but the situation is brought about by the rationing system created by this necessity of cutting back on the quantity of care provided. Miller, Benjamin, and North say that any government agency, a single medical provider in a country, acts as a monopsony, that is a single buyer, of health care services on behalf of everyone. Individuals are either prevented from buying health care on their own or limited by government rules as to what they may buy. Like other monopsonies, these national health insurance systems force down the prices of the goods they buy, such as drugs, medical devices, and physicians and nurses' services. So, how does this affect the quantity of goods and services provided? Of course, it's going to be a reduction. There will be less health care provided. So we can see this in a variety of ways. If you look at, this is an article, Mises Daily, that appeared about 3 years ago by Yuri Maltsev the Soviet healthcare system. It's a excellent article. I put it on the list on the reading list for this lecture. So if you go on the online schedule, you'll see that link. You should see that link there. But Maltsev says that if you look at a Brookings Institution study, there's not exactly a free market think tank, they found that every year 7,000 Britons in need of hip replacements, between 4,000 and 20,000 in need of coronary bypass surgery, and some 10 to 15,000 in need of cancer chemotherapy are denied medical attention. A colleague of mine needed hip replacement surgery some years ago. He went to his doctor. His doctor says, this is what you need to do. Go to the orthopedist. Orthopedist saw him very, very quickly. He could have had his hip replacement done within weeks of the diagnosis, maybe days of the diagnosis. He delayed it to the end of the school year so that he could have a recuperation time over the summer when his workload diminished. In many countries, you'd be waiting years for this kind of procedure. Age discrimination, Maltsev says, is particularly apparent in all government-run or heavily regulated systems of healthcare. In Russia, he says, he's an economist. In case you don't know, look him up on the Mises site. But he defected from the Soviet Union. I guess this would have been about 25 years ago. He's written a book called Requiem for Marx. Maybe you've heard of that. So Maltsev says patients over 60 are considered worthless parasites, and those over 70 are often denied even elementary forms of health care. In the UK, he says, in the treatment of chronic kidney failure, those who are 55 years old are refused treatment at 35% of dialysis centers. 45% of 65-year-old patients at the centers are denied treatment, while patients 75 or older rarely receive any medical attention at these centers. In Canada, the population is divided into three groups, age groups in terms of their access to health care: those below 45, those 45 to 65, and those over 65. So the priority treatment ends up going to those below 45. Maybe some of you have seen some of Michael Moore's documentaries. He produced one called Sicko, And maybe you've seen that. But he, Maltsev points out that he was really misleading in this documentary because he went and compared the healthcare services provided to younger people with routine, not routine necessarily, but fairly regular kinds of medical issues like childbirth and that kind of thing in countries with nationalized healthcare. And he found that it's very cheap, it goes off without a real problem, it's looks very nice, you can give birth to your child for some very, very low price. And then he compares that to medical treatment for elderly people with complex and sometimes incurable medical conditions in the United States. And in comparison, it makes the United States look like some kind of barbarous medical care system. But if Moore had, Maltsev says, if Moore had done the reverse and he'd compared the care provided in nationalized healthcare systems to elderly people with complex and incurable medical conditions in the UK or in Canada to Americans receiving, younger Americans receiving medical care here for routine kinds of medical issues, it would make the United States look like a very civilized medical process and make Canada and the UK look like the centers of barbarism. So it's really misleading. You have to look, and furthermore, you'll often hear, you know, Cuba has this very low infant mortality rate, and the United States is much higher. And the reason for this is that Cuba doesn't count infant deaths below a certain number of months. So your baby has to survive to a certain point before you even count the death if the child dies. So. Statistics can be used to mislead, and they often are, that has led to some misunderstandings about the relative status of American medical care. What we know about existing government intervention in the United States indicates that government medical care is certainly not going to improve upon what's left of a market system in the United States. I think, by the way, that it's a great mistake to refer to the United States as having a free market medical care system in comparison with, say, the UK or Canada or something. The only thing you can say is that, well, it's a little less statist than these other countries, but to call our system free market is absolutely false. It's not. There are some remnants of that left, but they're increasingly small. According to the AMA's 2008 National Health Insurance Report Card, Medicare denies nearly 7% of its claims, higher than any private insurer. If you look at the quantity of certain medical services provided in countries with national health care, you can see a diminishing quantity of those services. In 2006, there were 2.1 practicing physicians per 1,000 people in Canada and 2.4 per 1,000 in the United States. Even that difference is probably underestimating the real differences because in the United States, doctors will work longer hours than doctors will in Canada. Canada had 8.8 practicing nurses per 1,000, in the U.S., 10.5. Last year, I think it was at Mises University last year, Ronald Hamowy gave a talk called Canadian Medicare as a Model for the United States. Look that up on Mises Media. You can listen to the podcast. I don't think it was on video, but you can listen to the podcast on that. And that was excellent, as I recall, from last year. Medicaid's costs, like Medicare's, have risen far more than the cost of private health care. I'll show you a graph in a second. And that is occurring in spite of the fact that healthcare costs for the young have risen faster than the cost for the old over time. And Medicaid covers all age groups, not just the elderly, but Medicaid's costs are rising at similar speeds. So you take a look at this. This is the cost containment record of Medicare and Medicaid. That's the black line there. And then the red line there is all other health care in the United States, insurance provided or privately paid insurance or privately paid care. So since 1970 all the way up to 2008, the costs under the major government medical providers has increased faster than the private sector. So if you want to advertise government intervention as a kind of a way to cut back on costs, so far the evidence is that it's likely to increase costs, not decrease them. More evidence. In the United States, we have about 26.5 MRI machines per million people, and that was 6 years ago. It's probably higher now. 5.6 in the UK, 6.2 in Canada. 33.9 CT scanners per million people in the U.S. in 2006, 7.6 in the UK, and 12 in Canada. We know that the UK has higher rates of death from heart attack, stroke, and cancer than the United States. Canada has higher rates for heart attack and cancer. One of the other mistakes people make when trying to compare medical systems is they look at things like life expectancy, and then they say, well, life expectancy is some kind of proxy for looking at the quality of the medical care. And the United States may not compare as well in life expectancy to some other countries. Well, the medical profession can hardly be held to account for somebody DOA in the emergency room from a car accident. We do have higher car accident death rates in the United States than some other countries, and other factors that the medical profession has no direct control over, and maybe no indirect control over, like diet and other behaviors. Why are we saying that this is somehow the fault of the free market, that Americans tend to get into higher car accident rates? If you listen to Walter Block's lecture earlier in the week, you know that higher car accident rates may easily be due to road socialism. So why are we blaming this on the free market? Cancer survival rates are better in the United States. 62.9% of men diagnosed with cancer survive for at least 5 years. For women, it's 66%. Most countries with nationalized health care, like Great Britain, have a far worse rate. It's 44.8% for men and 52.7% for women, five-year survival rates. Wait times, I mentioned earlier, wait times are far higher in countries that have nationalized health care. You see the red bar there on the graph is the wait time for a specialist appointment after you've gotten your initial family practice doctor or general practitioner to see you. 74% of Americans see a specialist within 4 weeks. Only 10% have to wait 2 months or longer. But if you look at, say, Canada, Canadians, only 40% get to see a specialist within 4 weeks, and 42% have to wait for 2 months or longer. So our wait times tend to be lower. And then you get crazy stuff like this. You can't find medical care. It's free, but it's only free if you can find it. So there have been you can go on YouTube and find these videos of people who have gone to the free healthcare providers and the government healthcare providers in Canada and the UK, and the government healthcare providers will say, well, you know, we can't really see you, but if you really want care soon, then we suggest that you go over to the private sector provider over down the street. And that's really what people are left with, is either you go privately pay or you self-administer health care, which unfortunately it might be a little tempting to make a British joke here, but apparently the British are pulling out their own teeth. Imagine that. 6% of those questioned in a survey of 5,000 patients admitted they had resorted to self-treatment, including using pliers and glue. What do you say? More than three-fourths of those polled said they'd been forced to pay for private treatment because they'd been unable to find a National Health Services dentist. So, yeah, it's free if you can find it. One respondent said He took out most of his teeth in his shed with pliers. I have one to go. I don't want to know how much alcohol he had to consume before he decided to start yanking teeth. But Valerie Halsworth told British television's GMTV she had removed 7 of her own teeth using her husband's pliers when her toothache became unbearable, and she was unable to find an NHS dentist willing to treat her. It's hard to get around this without saying, well, this is a massive failure. And people are yanking out their own teeth with pliers. So I need to allow a few minutes for questions. I'll stop here, and if you have questions, feel free. Yes?
Aside from the problem with bed shortages and rationing care and the availability of expensive food in the world, Scottish people pulling their own teeth out. One of the main problems in the United Kingdom, as I see it, is not only are they inept when they're able to centralise information, but they're not good at centralising information. I mean, 2008, I think, the NHS tried to... they were talking for years about reinvigorating the NHS by centralising all the information, all the information they had on patients and putting it into one big computer system. And they spent something like, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds on the system, and it all fell through. It, for nothing. They just wasted all the money, and they couldn't put the computer system together. And that's precisely it. When you even have got the information, it leads to things like this. They can't even... And you mentioned this,
it's not just a matter of being able to collect quantifiable information. It's that much of the relevant information is not even quantifiable to start with. You can't put it into a form. How do you put into a form that a patient, you can prescribe a medication for a patient, but the patient is not likely to take the medication. They're likely instead to sell it to their neighbor to use for some kind of high. And so you might as well not even bother with the... with this particular traditional treatment, you're going to have to try a workaround to help this particular person. Maybe get their family involved, or yes.
As a Canadian, there seems to be a lot of love for socialized healthcare. It's like right up there with hockey and Tim Hortons and the national identity. So I'm wondering, what do you think about that? Since we've had socialized medicine since 1930s, and how do we get out of it being part of such a national myth with this sort of information that seems to be like glaring evidence that it's failing?
I think that you see a lot of Americans are misled by this as well. They look at Canada and they say, well, medication is so cheap in Canada. We can go to Canada and get cheap medicines. There must be something right about socialized medicine if you can get it so inexpensively. And what we forget is that there are effects that we're not seeing from the socialization of something like pharmaceuticals. The pharmaceutical companies are innovating in countries like the United States because they can actually sell their product at a price high enough to make a profit. And then a country like Canada comes along and says, all right, well, you've already invented this stuff. You're now producing it at an extremely low marginal cost, so sell it to us at this low marginal cost, or we're not going to allow your drug in the country. So if the United States were to move to something like that, we would remove one of the remaining incentives for pharmaceutical companies to innovate. And without the new drugs appearing on the market, some of which would actually be beneficial, we end up with long-term problems as innovation ceases. And I think that governments and government bureaucrats are pretty good at providing providing the public with cherry-picked bits of information that make their system look like it's pretty good, and doing the kind of the Michael Moore approach to it. See, if you have a baby in France, it costs 25 euro, and if you have a baby in the United States, it costs you the equivalent of maybe 2,500 euro, and that's why socialized medicine is better. But you know, if you're in certain other categories, it looks far, far worse. And so if you cherry-pick the data, it looks good. If you look at the full range of information, it looks terrible. Yes, in the back. I don't know much about the Singaporean system, but it sounds a lot like something like healthcare savings accounts here, which I think is a very good system because it makes the patient the residual claimant on the dollars. So if I don't use Medicaid dollars or Medicare dollars or insurance company dollars, then I don't get any benefit from it. But if I put money into a savings account, maybe a tax-favored savings account like an HSA, and then I show restraint and I am a good shopper when it comes to medical services, then the leftovers belong to me. So it gives me the incentive to behave with less of a moral hazard effect, to be a better shopper. And so I now care what the MRI costs. And the MRI provider has to respond to the patient and not to the insurance company. I think I saw another question. Very back. Yes. Yes. The mainstream medical profession has been very much opposed to the selling of organs like kidneys. And sometimes you'll read on this and you'll say, people will say, well, you know, some people wouldn't be able to afford the organs and that's just not fair. And therefore, we shouldn't allow these things to be marketed. The evidence suggests that apart from the ethical argument about whether or not it's fair, the evidence suggests that the market price would probably be fairly low, probably far lower than the cost of the surgery services themselves. And furthermore, what you're saying when you say, well, we shouldn't allow kidneys to be marketed because we're excluding certain people who can't afford the price, we're basically saying because a few people at the margin might not be able to afford that particular good, we're going to deny many times more of that good to other people who would be willing to pay. So we're consigning a lot of people to far greater suffering and expense simply because of an unwillingness to allow a good onto the marketplace. And I had a professor, when I was a graduate student here at Auburn, I had a professor who had kidney disease, and he was a very strong advocate of selling or marketing organs because he recognized that this would vastly improve the availability. And the whole idea that you're going to have people knocking somebody else out in a jar in a bar with a drink and you know, stealing their kidneys and leaving them in a bathtub full of ice is just okay. Look up urban legend, and that's what that is. That is, I think most of the kidneys would probably be cadaveric organ donations or sales. Somebody signs a form saying, "Well, for $400 now, I'll sign a form allowing somebody to claim my kidneys after I pass away." I mean, we walk around with $2,000 laptops, and we don't worry about people stealing those, and I think kidneys would be far less of a risk, so given the difficulty of theft. Boy, that's a really weird point to end this talk on, but I'll be happy to answer any other questions up here. Thank you.